Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and bad martinis with a definitely crazy chaser today for you. So stay tuned for some big stories and a lot of fun along the way. Jim, let's start with our good martini. There are a lot of stories about the number and rank of Republicans retiring from especially the House, but in some cases also the Senate as well this year. But there's been a couple important Democratic members of Congress to decide they want to do something else as well. And today we're definitely celebrating one of those. From Politico, Democratic Congressman Keith Ellison jumped into the race for Minnesota Attorney General Tuesday, the final day candidates were allowed to file. Ellison won't leave Congress immediately, but he will not run for re-election. He will also remain deputy chair of the Democratic National Committee during his campaign. In a statement, Ellison says, "No one, not even a president, is above the law, from immigration reform to protecting our air and water. It has never been more important to have a leader as attorney general who can stand up against threats to our neighbors' health or freedoms." This obviously leads to political chaos since he made this decision on the last day of filing. There's a lot of people now jockeying for his seat. He's gotten a number of endorsements along the way, but one he hasn't gotten yet, Jim, curiously enough, is DNC Chairman Tom Perez, since these guys come from different wings of the Democratic Party. The good news is that Keith Ellison won't be in Washington much longer. The bad news is he might be making important judicial decisions in the state of Minnesota. Hopefully he fails at that, and he'll be out of all of our hair soon.
Greg, one way to interpret this is that the state attorney general position has suddenly become kind of glamorous in politics. There are quite a few Republicans during the Obama years who basically were able to use the position as a way of kind of, you know, showcasing their conservative record, ways to emphasize how they're fighting the good fight on a variety of issues. You get to file lawsuits against the administration, and whether or not those lawsuits actually go anywhere, you're seen amongst partisans as somebody who's finally, you know, putting the president in his place and all that kind of stuff. Patrick Morrissey, the Republican nominee for Senate in West Virginia, basically killed off the Clean Air Power Plan that was going to effectively write off the coal industry in West Virginia. Running on that, that's, you know, arguably what won him the hard-fought primary. So if you're a Democrat and you've got ambitions, the state attorney general position is one where you can do quite a bit, and you don't have to live in Washington. Worth noting, though, that, you know, Minnesota is a state that Trump only lost by 2 percentage points. It's kind of one of those, it's obviously got a lot of progressives in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, but the rest of the state is, you know, fairly rural, fairly traditional, very much that white working class group of voters who are kind of swinging. You once were longtime, you know, Democrats who are kind of shifting that way. So I don't think Ellison is a slam dunk for this position. And this is even if he wins the primary, which is by no means guaranteed either. He's created another tough primary fight for Minnesota Democrats. The aspect of the Democratic National Committee chair, so he's going to stay DNC vice chair for his campaign. Presumably he would stop once he stopped being, started the job of state attorney general if he won that. A lot of reports that he and Perez are not getting along. I can imagine under any circumstances, it's probably less than thrilling to run for a job, not win, and you have to basically be the number two of the guy you ran against. Kind of like the way we used to do with the president and vice president in this country. And every time, you know, Tom Perez makes a decision, Ellison doesn't really get to gripe about it publicly. Then beyond that, look, one of the other arguments, the rumors going around is that Ellison says he's tired of being the minority. Greg, wasn't there supposed to be a blue wave that was going to sweep Democrats into control of the House this November? Wasn't that a guarantee we were told from certain folks? So you kind of, I'm left with that. This, look, this doesn't mean that the wave isn't going to occur, but it certainly is an interesting indicator that Keith Ellison is not certain that it's going to be more fun to be part of the Democratic Party starting in January 2019 than it is right now. Or maybe he's just really fed up with everybody else. But it's kind of very interesting. Obviously, the lone Muslim in Congress, a guy who is largely seen as sort of a rising star and a symbol of you know, standing up against an Islamophobic Trump administration, et cetera, and now all of a sudden he wants to go back home to Minnesota and not all that interested in fighting the fight in D.C. anymore. So kind of interesting, causes headaches for the Democrats. Something to keep an eye on in Minnesota in the next couple of months.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the blue wave, as you said, it obviously could still happen. We've certainly seen it in previous elections. Virginia, most close to home here for us last fall. But if you look at some of the numbers in the primaries, particularly out in California, compared to what you would normally see, obviously primary elections don't get the turnout that general elections do, but not exciting numbers overall out in California yesterday. But we will see what happens as time goes on and which side has the momentum heading into November. Let's go to our first bad martini now, Jim. And I first saw this story when it came on an AP tweet yesterday afternoon. It said, breaking government, Medicare will become insolvent in 2026. 3 years earlier than expected, Social Security to follow in 2034. Now, you and I are of an age where that's still, you know, we grew up in the 90s. The 2020 seems like a long way away. That's only 8 years from now that Medicare will be insolvent and Social Security just 8 years after that. So here's the story from the Washington Times. Social Security will spend more than it collects this year. The program's trustees said Tuesday, marking the first time in more than 35 years that it will run an annual deficit as it slides towards insolvency by 2034. Medicare's main trust fund is in even worse shape, scheduled to hit insolvency in 2026, 3 years earlier than last year's estimate, the trustees said. The twin warnings add even more pressure to a budget already strained by last year's tax cuts and this year's deal to boost spending on defense and basic domestic needs, leaving few bright spots in the federal fiscal picture. And Jim, that's depressing enough, particularly for folks our age who have paid into the system for a good couple of decades now, and it doesn't look like it's going to be around necessarily for our retirement unless major reforms are done. We've seen in previous administrations, previous Congresses, some people start to tinker with entitlements and they get blasted. You know, used to be known as the third rail of American politics. And just to show you how much the media and the people care about this, I went on the homepages of ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, and Fox, and not one of them had this story. What do you make of it?
Greg, you're disappointed with this news, but you're not surprised, right?
Oh, I'm not surprised at all. I'm shocked that nobody cares, though.
I mean, it's one of those things where you're saying we've been hearing about this in the 90s. I'm pretty sure I remember reading my first article in my early teen years, which would put it in the 80s. Greg, we heard about Reagan running up the deficits and how terrible the debt was. I think it might have been, you know, $1 trillion at that point, Greg. You know, $1 trillion debt. Could you imagine that? My goodness.
Yeah.
Really terrible. Now that we're, you know, past 20 trillion. One of the things that's, you know, I used to get really frustrated by this. I've now turned into something more of an open cynic about it. A lot of different ways you could kind of point to the measuring stick of our unseriousness, our unwillingness to address this. 2008 presidential debate, they put the question to McCain, they put the question to Obama, and Obama's answer is, you know, indeed, we do need to worry about our deficit and our debt and our spending, but I'll tell you what we're not going to do. We're not going to cut Social Security for all those hardworking seniors. You know, and he goes to the long list of all the things he's not going to cut, and he never quite gets around to anything that he is willing to do in terms of entitlement reform. Talk of a grand bargain, that didn't occur. I think it was Ace of Spades who had made the point that for a long time, entitlement reform and your approach to entitlements was kind of one of your measuring sticks of the Washington media, not even just the mainstream media, but I'd say the folks who really kind of covered politics and knew how government worked, knew that this was a giant ticking time bomb that everybody just pretended they didn't hear. And if you wanted to run for president, probably the Bob Novaks of the world would at some point, or maybe the David Broders would ask you this question, or Tim Russert. And one of the measuring sticks of your seriousness was, do you have a plan to deal with this? Do you recognize this is a problem? What do you want to do about this problem? And what solutions can you put on the table? And anyway, Ace points out that in 2012, that stopped all of a sudden. Mitt Romney probably had more focus on this than any other Republican candidate. Paul Ryan is running mate. These guys probably did more and thought more and had plotted out and run the numbers on entitlement reform more than any other Republican ticket in the past, 30 years. Wasn't that huge an issue in 2012? And the press that was covering it, when Obama, Romney laid out the numbers about why this needed to be done and why the country was risking fiscal ruin and interest payments on the debt eating up more and more of the federal budget if we didn't do something. And they turned the question to Obama. This was in that first debate that didn't go so well for him. And I remember Obama saying something along the lines of, you've just heard a lot about the numbers of Social Security, but I want to talk about the values of Social Security. And I don't know about you, Greg. Every time I was called on in class and I had not done the reading, I would shift from the specifics of the reading to the general values of the reading that I'd picked up in the 2 minutes that I'd brushed through it in the and now, you know, I'm not saying that I was a, you know, okay, yes, I was BSing my way through the answer. And you, a lot of the times you could make through it. But I heard that from Obama and I was like, aha, he hasn't done the reading. He cannot refute the numbers. He knows the math doesn't add up. He knows we've got, you know, too much money going out, not enough money going in. He doesn't want to say that he's going to raise taxes, or if he does, we're only going to raise taxes on the rich and all that kind of stuff. Look, we put this question before the voters in 2012, and you could argue in quite a few races before then, quite a few races after them. The American people, you know, you could look at the Republican field in 2016. Of the, you know, 17 candidates, probably about 15 of them had serious plans and had, you know, talked about the importance of the deficit and the debt and the need for entitlement reform. The two exceptions were Mike Huckabee and Donald Trump. Donald Trump said he wasn't going to touch Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. Republicans voted for him. In some ways, I'm going to say something that might hurt, Greg. Words can hurt, so I'm going to be careful. The way that, you know, people, gun control advocates say, it's time for a national conversation about gun control after every mass shooting, and the response, actually, we have them all the time. You guys just don't like how the conversation goes. We do need a national conversation about entitlement spending, Greg. I would argue that we kind of have, maybe not at the volume and level of detail and depth that you and I would like, but we do have them. And every single time, the American people pick the guy who says, no, it's not really a problem. Don't worry about it. And there's always a candidate who's willing to say, oh, don't worry, this will take care of itself. Or, oh, don't worry, we can solve this by raising taxes on the rich. Whoever says this is not a problem is going to win that debate. It does not speak well of us as Americans. It does not speak well of our system of government. But we have created an incentive structure for ignoring the problem. Whoever ignores the problem wins in our elections. And I think it's going to be that way until the ticking time bomb goes off. If the deficit, you know, because right now the deficit and the debt and all the problems we have in entitlements, the trust funds running out, they're just numbers on a page. If it was a giant Godzilla-like monster, Greg, people would recognize it. And this is the fiscal equivalent of a giant Godzilla-like monster, but nobody's willing to really address it because it's not tangible. They can't see it. They can't feel it. They're not going to do anything until the train, the oncoming train is right in front of them. And I wish it were otherwise, but I've kind of realized, I've asked, you know, it is something of a fair question to ask. How many times should Republicans try to drag the country kicking and screaming towards a path of fiscal responsibility that they absolutely refuse to embrace?
No, that's exactly right. George W. Bush tried to offer a sliver of your Social Security taxes to put that into private accounts, and he was pilloried even by his own party. His own party controlled the House and the Senate. They wanted nothing to do with it, eventually abandoned the idea. Bill Clinton, I think, had a Medicare reform panel headed up by John Breaux, if I remember correctly, about 20 years ago. Nothing ever happened with that because nobody ever had the courage to deal with it.
Save Social Security first at the State of the Union. That was his rallying cry.
Yes. And so, remember Obama talking about using a scalpel, not a hatchet? I think we need a guillotine at this point to take care of this stuff. But you're right. The people just, it's not a priority for them. And it you wonder why it doesn't get more attention. I remember Shep Smith back when Michael Jackson was getting arrested and it was wall-to-wall coverage, or when the end was near for Terry Schiavo. And Shep Smith explained, we got to talk about this every 15 minutes because we have new people coming in. And CNN during the Schiavo situation saying, if we talk about anything else, our ratings plummet. And so they're largely catering to what people want to hear. And sadly, this isn't it.
This is not a hemlock martini. It's not meant to make people feel absolutely terrible, although maybe a Logan's Run type solution might get us out of the long-term problems of Social Security, Greg. Look, we hear a lot about, you know, with the last 2 years, the rise of the alt-right. Oh, my goodness, Brexit passed. Oh, my goodness, Trump won. Is liberal democracy failing? Are people losing faith in elections? Or, you know, And very often, a lot of this is code for a candidate I don't like won. Thus, right. What's wrong with the country? Yes. Right? The candidate I voted for did not get more votes or the lost the Electoral College. Ergo, the system is broken. But this is one case where I do think you can make the argument that American governance is not working the way it should. But the thing is that deep down, I don't know if this is really an issue of our governance. Or to get really depressing, Greg. Our national character, right? I mean, you know, look, we all kind of, you know, every time you pick up an advice book, the advice is generally what we know. And I'm speaking from experience. Oh, you weigh too much? Well, you probably should exercise more and eat less, right? You know, that's, you know, there's all kind of different varieties of that, but that's generally the advice you're going to get. You've got a system of taking care of the elderly, providing medical care for the elderly, and providing medical care for the very poor, and too much money is going out, not enough money is going in. At some point, you're going to reach the point where there are too many retirees who are living longer. Thank God. That's great. It's wonderful. We all want to see grandma and grandpa live as long as they can. But we have not enough workers kicking in taxes to keep the system going. There is no trust fund. There is no lockbox, as Al Gore had said in the 2000 debates. As soon as the money comes in, it goes out, and the government writes itself an IOU. This has never been a good, sustainable system. But every time you pointed to this, people would point to the government numbers and say, no, 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 this isn't going to – we're fine until 2030. And every couple of years, the government looks at the numbers and says, well, actually, we got to move up the date of the day the bomb explodes a little bit sooner. And yesterday, they put it up 3 years. It ultimately is a character issue. Can we focus on a real problem like this? This is, you know, the issue of entitlement reform doesn't really make for dramatic visuals. It doesn't really make that well for, you know, you can demonize certain groups, I guess, but in the end, almost everybody benefits from this in one form or another. Almost everybody kicks into it. There's not anybody who's very easy to scapegoat. You know, it doesn't make, it's not sexy. It's not violent. It involves a lot of math. And almost, you could say that our national motto or slogan should not be out of many one, but should be what Chevy Chase said as Gerald Ford in the Saturday Night Live debate sketch. It was my understanding that there would be no math involved.
No, that's exactly right. You see these stories every once in a while about the disturbingly high percentage of Americans that couldn't deal with a surprise $1,000 expense. I guess when you see stuff like that, it's probably not a huge shock that they're not worried about being $21 trillion in debt. So anyway, enough of the scolding. Let's move on to our second bad martini. If you're frustrated with domestic politics, I'm sure Iran will cheer you up. From Fox News, the Obama administration, the scandal-free, as you'll recall, Obama administration, granted a license letting Iran access the United States financial system, despite officials' pledges that they would prohibit it, according to a draft report from the Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. Quote, on February 24th, 2016, the Treasury Department issued a specific license to Bank Muscat, that's the in Oman, to authorize the conversion of Iran's rials to euros through any United States depository institution, the draft report said. Even after the specific license was issued, U.S. government officials maintained in congressional testimony that Iran would not be granted access to the U.S. financial system. Quote, the Obama administration during the negotiation of the Iran deal misled the American people, said Senator Rob Portman, the subcommittee chairman. I think they did so because they were desperate to get a deal. The good news here is that the Obama administration approached two U.S. banks to make the conversion from rials, and ultimately those banks declined, so they had to use European banks. So there is some integrity in U.S. financial institutions, Jim, so that's good news. But the duplicity of the Obama administration here, again, just like the last martini, not surprising, but still outrageous.
Greg, I picked up Ben Rhodes' new autobiography at the bookstore yesterday. Flipped through it, and I put it down very quickly. It's basically exactly what you would expect. But I think what we see here, coupled with, and in the morning jolt, I kind of laid out a couple of the other things they said about the Iran deal that, oh, oops, sorry, turned out to not quite be so true. At one point, they were insisting, no, not a single embargo or punishment or restriction on Iran comes off until they fully comply. Not really. It's not the way it worked. Iran has fully accounted for all of its nuclear activities. No, they really didn't do that either. You can go down the list and basically say all the different ways and times in which the Iran deal had to be misrepresented. And Ben Rhodes was arrogant enough to brag about how he was able to say whatever he wanted to the White House press corps, and they would just repeat what he said. Now, as I said, if you have to constantly lie about a deal, it's probably not a good one. And I really would kind of like to see a top-to-bottom, I don't want to say, cleansing of our political system. But I'm going to give you a slightly different – the argument I'm sure of Ben Rhodes and the Obama administration was like, look, of course we couldn't admit that we were going to give Iran some temporary access to U.S. banks, because if we did that, people would freak out and the deal would go off. Well, maybe the people are right. Maybe the people have good reason to think that that you shouldn't do something like that. You know, that if you really think that the public is wrong on this, then try to explain it to them, right? Try to say, no. If we give Iran a little bit of access to U.S. banks, it's not going to be that bad. But then it's on you to prove why it wouldn't be that bad and why it doesn't represent this giant unilateral concession to a regime that had demonstrated absolutely no indication that it was improving its behavior whatsoever. I was thinking about something else that it's a domestic issue. It kind of relates to it. Yesterday, you may have seen the news, Greg, that David Hogg, the infamously, vehemently pro-gun control student from Parkland High School, he was swatted. Somebody called the cops, said that there was a hostage situation in his house. Cops responded with a SWAT team. Turns out his family was not home, thank God. This has happened to a bunch of people. It was going around with conservative bloggers a couple years ago. Swatting is a crime. Don't you dare think about doing it. David Hogg came out and made a statement saying he's not going to be distracted by a silly prank. And a couple of people kind of reacted surprisingly. Silly prank? That's really not a good or accurate way of describing this. You SWAT, people got killed in SWAT raids gone wrong. What's going on here? And then Eric Erickson, who had this happen to him and his family a couple of years ago, said, look, when this first happened, some people, I didn't really specify which people. I don't know if it was CNN where he was working at the time, the police or someone else told him not to make a big deal out of it. I guess the fear was that it could encourage copycats, that other people would try to do this. Maybe David Hogg is getting the same advice from somebody. I think that's bad advice, because when you say, oh, this is just a silly prank, and it's not, it's a crime, you could get somebody killed. Like, a big debate is about whether this should be seen as simply filing a false police report or attempted murder, or at the very least, reckless endangerment to do something like this. There are a lot of cases where people will try to argue, Greg, that, well, if we tell this little lie, it's for the greater good. And my sneaky suspicion is that no, in a lot of cases, it's not really for the greater good. It may be for your particular good. It may be good for you in that circumstance, but it's not really for the greater good. And I'd say anytime you have a negotiation with another country, and yes, sometimes topics are sensitive. Yes, some things, you got to worry about public backlash, et cetera, et cetera. But the more you have to lie to your own country about what a deal does, it's probably a sign that it's a bad deal.
Oh, that's exactly right. When you factor in John Kerry arrogantly telling Congress that it's not going to be submitted as a treaty because that would be hard, and he couldn't get the votes for it.
That one was honest, Greg. Let's give him credit for honesty.
It's true, but it's not a reason for skirting the Constitution. And then, of course, we talked last week about Ben Rhodes when the video came out about his blatant manipulation of a compliant media or a clueless media when it came to the details of the Iran negotiations. I mean, they just brazenly deceived the American people to achieve a legacy item that is now headed towards the ash heap of history, thankfully. So what we really need with Iran, Jim, is an unconventional diplomat who can get in there, perhaps find some common ground with the mullahs or hopefully a new regime at some point, and just kind of put these nuclear tensions to ease, because clearly that was the key to success in North Korea. Now that we find out that Dennis Rodman, who was buddies with Kim Jong-il and now Kim Jong-un, plans to be in Singapore on June 12th and may very well end up at this summit. It's not confirmed that he's actually officially part of the summit, but the former fantastic defensive player for the Pistons and Bulls and some other teams is apparently a critical cog in this machine.
You know, this had been one of the first jokes that came out of, oh, Donald Trump's running for president. Who's he going to have as his Secretary of State? Dennis Rodman?
Right.
And here we are, America. He's not official. He's not Secretary of State. He's not an official diplomat, but he's going to be in town. If he's in town, he's buddies with both of them. I mean, like, the odds of at least one photo op don't seem utterly unthinkable. This is one of the reasons, one of the dangers of nominating a celebrity president in America. You just don't know what the consequence, where it's going to end up. Look, maybe he just ends up doing, autograph signings or some event in Singapore at that time or something like that. But knowing Trump, knowing Kim, and knowing Rodman, anybody want to bet a lot of money that they don't all get together at some point?
Who else from Celebrity Apprentice is going to end up with a role in this administration? We've had Omarosa. He's now toying with a Blagojevich commutation. He was on that show, I'm pretty sure. And now Rodman. So I didn't watch it regularly enough to know who else. Is Gary Busey up for a cabinet position at some point? I mean, this could get very interesting.
I didn't realize the two different T-shirts you could have had in the 2016 election, Greg. You could have had I'm with her and I'm with Busey.
Oh, man. Busey. Wow. Jim, it's amazing that this is where we are, but it's exactly where we are. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.